according to the answer given by the Venerable Sariputta in the discourse Silawanda Sutta. A monk who is virtuous or who has pure sila, sits like this, vipassana meditation to see the five aggregates of clinging as impermanence and so on. Now there is a sutta next to that sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya. We can call that Sista Sutta. And that sutta is called Sutta Vanta Sutta. It is almost the same as the Silawanda Sutta. So the only difference in the second sutta is the description of the monk as in Pali Sutta Vanta. In English it is translated as instructed. Now the word sutta means heard. In the ancient times, writing materials were not easily available, and also maybe it was a custom during those days not to write down the teachings of the Buddha on anything. So the teacher talks and the student listens to the talk. So that is why this word sutta comes to be used for something a person has learned. So sutta-vanta means one who possesses, learns knowledge. That means one who possesses knowledge, one who is knowledgeable. So in this discourse, Venerable Mahakothita asks Venerable Sariputta the same question. What are the things that an instructed bhikkhu should carefully attend to? And the answer is also the same. So we can take these two suttas as one, and then say a monk who is virtuous and who has necessary knowledge of the Buddha's teaching must carefully attend to the five aggregates of clinging as impermanent and so on. In order to see five aggregates of clinging as impermanent and so on, what do we need? We need concentration. So without concentration, we cannot hope to see the five aggregates of clinging as impermanent and so on. So concentration is an important factor in the practice of meditation. Whether you practice samatha meditation or vipassana meditation, you need to have concentration. So concentration, we can say concentration is an essential part of the practice of meditation. Now to get concentration, what must we do? We must practice mindfulness. Without mindfulness, we cannot get concentration. Because mindfulness is the full awareness of the object, and if there is no full awareness of the object, there can be no concentration in the mind. So we need to practice mindfulness to get concentration. And in order to get to practice mindfulness, what do we need? We need effort. We must make effort. If we do not make effort, we will not, or we cannot practice mindfulness. So now there are three things important in the practice of meditation. They are concentration, mindfulness, and effort. First, we make effort to be mindful, and then we are mindful. And with the support of effort and mindfulness, we get concentration. So once we get concentration, once we get stillness of mind, mind free from mental hindrances, we will begin to see the five aggregates of clinging as impermanent and so on. Among the three things important in meditation, mindfulness needs to be strong. The stronger it is, the better. Because it is said that mindfulness is required in all cases, and there can be no excess of mindfulness. We cannot say that mindfulness is too strong. So we need mindfulness to be strong. But the other two, the effort and concentration, we need to be careful. Effort can be too little or too much, and concentration can be too little and too much. If there is too little effort, we cannot practice mindfulness. And if there is too much effort, we cannot practice mindfulness either. Because too much effort will lead us to agitation and restlessness. And too much effort can come when a yogi is very eager to achieve, or very eager to reach enlightenment, very eager to get results, and so on. With that eagerness, he or she may make more effort than is needed. So when more effort than needed is made, mind becomes stirred or trembled. And so there is the agitation of mind. So when mind is agitated, it cannot stay on the object. And so too much effort is to be avoided when practicing meditation. And there is a saying that too much effort leads to agitation or restlessness. Concentration also can be too much. So when there is too much concentration, a yogi tends to lose effort or to reduce effort. And when concentration gains the upper hand, or when concentration becomes too much, a yogi tends to become lazy or sleepy. So when he becomes lazy, that means his effort level has gone down. So when there is less effort than is necessary, concentration suffers. So when there is too much concentration, there is a tendency to become lazy and sleepy. So in order for the practice of meditation to go smoothly, these two need to be just just enough for the purpose. Or it is said that they need to be balanced. Now, how to balance these two? In this case, we don't need to worry. That is, if we follow the instructions. Our teachers, being aware of this problem, have given us instruction to follow, and if we follow their instruction, we will not have too much effort or too much concentration. Now, when you practice, you are instructed to be mindful of two things, in-breath and out-breath, or rising and falling of the abdomen. But when other objects become prominent at the moment, you have to be mindful of that object too. But the basic practice is to be mindful of two objects, not simultaneously of the two objects, but to take two objects at a time. So find two objects. Why not just one object? Or why not more than two objects? If you have to be mindful of more than two objects, it will tend to make you agitated. So there may be too much effort then is necessary. And if you have to keep your mind on one object only, it tends to make concentration too much. Because now you have only one object to attend to, and so you put your mind totally on that object, and so you get concentration. So in that case, concentration can be too much. So in order for your effort not to be too much and not to be too little, you are given two things to be mindful of at a time. So being mindful of two things at a time helps you to balance these two important factors in the practice of meditation, the effort and concentration. So they must always be balanced. They must always be just the right amount, and they must not be too much or too little. So in the answer, the Venerable Sariputta said, a virtuous bhikkhu and an instructed bhikkhu should attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent and so on. Now, regarding the word instructed bhikkhu, how much knowledge should a person possess before he or she practices meditation? Now, if you read Visuddhimagga, you may get the notion that you have to know a lot before you practice Vipassana meditation. Now, Visuddhimagga is a book written by a monk for meditating monks. So many of the teachings are taken for granted that his readers would understand. But for those who are not initiated into the teachings of the Buddha, it is not an easy book to read. So when he wrote this book for meditating monks, he divided the book into three divisions. The first division is for sila, and how to purify one sila and so on. And the second division is on samadhi or concentration. So in the second division, he explains the 40 subjects of samatha meditation and how to prepare for meditation, how to find a teacher and so on. So there are many details of the samatha meditation in the second division. And also he explained about the abhinyas or direct knowledges. They are the special knowledge a yogi can get after he gains the material and immaterial jhanas. And after explaining those things, after explaining the concentration, he went on to explain the third division is on understanding of panya. Actually, that division is on vipassana. So when he wrote the third division, he began with giving information on the aggregate, the basis, elements, faculties, Four Noble Truths, and dependent origination, all in detail. And only after that, he describes the practice of vipassana meditation. So, reading Visuddhimagga may give you the impression that you have to be familiar with these details of aggregate and so on. You have to be very familiar with the dependent teaching of dependent origination before you can practice vipassana meditation. I don't think everyone of you is familiar with all these requirements. One Sakka, the king of gods, asked the Buddha how much knowledge a monk must have to practice and to reach arahantship. And Buddha answered, "A bhikkhu has heard that all things are not fit to be adhered to. When a bhikkhu has heard that all things are not fit to be adhered to, he directly knows everything and so on." That means after he has heard that all things are not to be adhered to by craving, by wrong view and so on, he can practice meditation. So that means he just needs to have heard this much, that all things are not to be taken as, let's say, permanent happiness and soul or self. So if a monk knows just that much, then he can practice meditation. So according to this, a person doesn't have to know much about the teachings of the Buddha in order to practice meditation. I hope you will like it. Now the commentary adds a little more. The commentary says, if a monk knows that there are four noble truths and two of them belong to the round of rebirth and the other two lead to getting out of the round of rebirth, and when you practice meditation you have to deal with the first two and not the second two, So if you know this much, you have enough knowledge to practice meditation. So in this case, you need to have heard that there are Four Noble Truths. You already have heard about this, right? So there are Four Noble Truths, and the two belong to mundane, and the other two are like super mundane. And when you practice vipassana, you deal with the first two, the truth of suffering and truth of the origin of suffering, not the other two, because the other two, among the other two, the third noble truth, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering is to be realized, and the fourth noble truth arises at the moment of enlightenment. So the fourth noble truth is actually the result of the practice of vipassana meditation. So if you know this much, you have enough knowledge to practice vipassana meditation. And what about understanding the dependent origination? It has been explained in Visuddhimagga in great detail. Now in this case, the sub-commentary comes to our aid. The sub-commentary says, if you know that there is cause and there are results of that cause, then you know the dependent origination. So if, even if you don't know the details of the dependent origination, if you know that there are causes and there are the results of these causes, and they are related as cause and effect, then you're virtually said to be that you have the knowledge of dependent origination. Because dependent origination, in brief, is a teaching that the states, material state and mental state in beings arise always dependent upon some condition. So according to that teaching, everything in the world is conditioning. So if we know just that, there are conditions and there are those that are conditioned by those conditions, then it is enough for us to say that we understand the dependent origination. So this information is from the text and the commentaries and sub-commentaries. Now, let us think about this as those who have no knowledge of the text or commentaries, but who have some ability to think. Buddha gave his first sermon 2 months after his enlightenment, and there were 5 human beings listening to his talk. You know those 5 human beings? The group of 5 disciples. Do you think they had the knowledge of aggregate spaces and so on at that time? Buddha had not given any discourse at that time, so Buddha has not taught the aggregate and so on, much less the dependent origination. But they listened to the sermon, and maybe they practiced under the guidance of the Buddha, and they reached enlightenment. So can you say that the five disciples knew Abhidhamma? They have knowledge of the aggregate and so on. They definitely did not possess such knowledge. Only one thing we can say, and that is, oh, they are gifted persons. they have accumulated a lot of paramis, a lot of experience in the past, and so they are special persons, and so when they hear the Buddha talk, all this information might have come to them. But as ordinary persons, I think we can say that they did not know anything about the aggregate and so on when Buddha gave the first sermon. But they got the results of listening to the first sermon. All of them became sotapannas and later arahants. We can find many examples of this nature in the texts as well as in the commentaries. So let us take just one more example of Venerable Sariputta. So when Venerable Sariputta met the Venerable Asaji, he was not yet a Buddhist. At that time he belonged to another faith or another teaching. He met the Venerable Asaji and then asked him to teach him, and the Venerable Asaji uttered a verse, and he listened to that verse, and it is said that after listening to half of that verse, the Venerable Sariputta became a sotapanna. So again, Venerable Sariputta must have not known the five aggregates and so on at that time, because although it was a little later, it was during the second vasa of the Buddha, when the Buddha was spending his second vasa in the city of Rajagaha. So Sariputta did not know much about the Buddha's teachings when he met the Venerable Asaji, and he became a sotapanna, and later he became a disciple of the Buddha. Again, we can say that Sariputta was the most gifted person after the Buddha, and so it is not difficult for him to get this knowledge at the moment he heard the teaching given to him by the Venerable Asaji. We are not as gifted as the five disciples or the Venerable Sariputta. And we became human beings more than 2,500 years after the Buddha. So I think we should compromise. So we should know something about the teaching of the Buddha, but not very much. So if you know that there are five aggregates, and Buddha taught that these five aggregates are impermanent, suffering, and not self, and there are four noble truths and so on. So just about that, if you have heard or read, or if you already know, I think you can practice Vipassana meditation. But if you have a knowledge of these aggregates and so on, it is good. Because if you have the knowledge of the aggregates and so on, you can verify your practice with what you already know. So you practice meditation and you experience many things. Sometimes you don't know what they are because you do not have the knowledge of all these aggregates and so on. So if you have a sound knowledge of the aggregates and so on, And you will know what's happening to you, what you are experiencing. Like a person who has read a map before going to a place. So when he is in that place, he knows where he is or where to go and so on. And also, since you are practicing not by yourself, but under the guidance of a teacher or under the guidance of teachers, I think it is enough if you have just a little bit of information about the teachings of the Buddha. So through the talks, your teacher can give you enough information to you about five aggregates, about nama and rupa, and so on. So it is okay for you to practice vipassana meditation even if you have not read Visuddhimagga, even if you do not know Abhidhamma. So whatever is necessary for you to know, your teachers will supply you with this kind of knowledge. I'm not telling this to encourage you not to study the teachings of the Buddha. So it is good to study the teachings of the Buddha, and it is good to know what the Buddha taught. But if you are bent on practice, I want to tell you that it is possible for you to practice right now, even though you do not have the detailed information, detailed knowledge of the teachings of the Buddha. But if you want to share your knowledge with other people, if you want to be a teacher in the future, or if you are a teacher yourself now, then you definitely need a wide knowledge of the teachings of the Buddha. So now, we will go to the answer given by the Venerable Sariputta. So he said, the virtuous and instructed bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging as impermanent. So let us talk about impermanent now. The commentaries say that we should know three things regarding impermanence. And they are, what is it that is impermanent? That is number one. So we say impermanent, impermanent. What is that? What is that we say is impermanent? The second one is the characteristic or the mark or the sign of impermanence. That means, what are the signs? What are the marks of being impermanent? And the third is the repeated seeing of impermanence. So what is it that is impermanent? When we say impermanent, impermanent, what do we mean by that? You already know the answer, right? What is it that is impermanent? Five aggregates. Five aggregates are those that are impermanent, or that are taught by the Buddha as impermanent. We have yet to see that it is true through our practice of vipassana meditation. So, what is it that is impermanent? The answer is the five aggregates. Here, all five aggregates, not just five aggregates of clinging. Now, there is a difference between aggregates and aggregates of clinging. When we say aggregate, the supramundane aggregates are also included. But when we say aggregates of clinging, we mean only the mundane aggregates. So both mundane and supramundane aggregates are impermanent. Now, part consciousness belongs to supramundane aggregates. Part consciousness belongs to consciousness aggregates, and it belongs to supramundane level. But that part consciousness arises and disappears immediately to be followed by fruition consciousness, which again disappears immediately, and so on. So the types of consciousness that are included in the supramundane aggregate are also impermanent. So when we say impermanent, we mean all things in the world. Everything in the world is impermanent. But if we want to use the language of the books, we say five aggregates. So now we know that five aggregates are impermanent. Why do we say that five aggregates are impermanent? Seeing what do we say that they are impermanent? There must be some signs or some marks that point to their being impermanent. Now these signs or characteristics are like flags. So by flags, people identify themselves. Now, looking at the flags, we know that this group is from the United States, this group is from this country, that country. So the flag is the characteristic of those people, or mark or sign of those people. So in the same way, there must be something like the flag here, by which we understand that these five aggregates are impermanent. And I think you all know that characteristic. Visuddhimagga said, rise and fall and change are the characteristics of impermanence. They rise, they fall, that means they disappear, and they change, that means they age. First there is arising, and then there is what is called change, becoming different, or aging. And then there is fall or disappearing. So when we watch these aggregates, we see that they come, they arise, and then they may last for some brief moment, and then they disappear. So when we see that they arise, they let it change, and they disappear, we know that they are impermanent. So these are the characteristics. These are the marks. These are the signs for their being impermanent. So what is the characteristic of impermanence? We say rise, fall, and change. That means you are, I hope you are familiar with the three stages of existence, arising and staying for some time and then disappearing. So these three are called the three sub-moments of one thought moment. So when we see some state arise and stay for some time and disappear, we know that that state is impermanent. And that knowing or seeing that they are impermanent must come from our experience. It must not come from the book. It must not come from the teacher speaking. It must come from within, You must see for yourself, not just satisfied with what you read in the books or what you hear at the talks. So in order to see the impermanence, as Venerable Sariputta advised, we need to practice. We need to do something so that we see them for ourselves. We see them and we see that they are really impermanent. So in order to see that they are impermanent, what must we do? We must watch them. It's very simple, actually. You watch them and you will not fail to see that they arise and they disappear. Now you are practicing Vipassana meditation and sometimes you are making notes of your mind. Your mind goes out, wanders, and then you are still wandering, 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 and then it is finished and then you come back to the home object. So you see, or you know for yourself, through your own experience, that thought is impermanent because it arises and then it stays for some time, it is very short time, and then it disappears. So the impermanence of five aggregates or impermanence of mind and matter can be seen for ourselves through practice of Vipassana meditation. Once we have seen for ourselves the impermanence of things, we don't have to go by faith. We don't have to have faith in anybody's saying at all. Now that we have seen it for ourselves, we can verify that it is true. So we don't have to blindly take the statements of other people regarding the impermanence of the five aggregates. So if we want to do that, we must practice. And if we practice and we pay close attention to the objects that are at the present moment, we will not fail to see this. So it is very encouraging that we can discover, we can call it the secret. We can discover the secrets of mind and matter as taught by the Buddha through our own experience. So that is what is called sandhikita, the attribute of the Dhamma. It can be seen by oneself, or it is to be seen by oneself, not just to be heard from another person. The commentary describes this characteristic in another way, although it means the same thing. It says, non-existence after having been is the characteristic of impermanence. Non-existence after having been is the characteristic of impermanence. Book language is different from everyday language. But sometimes we want to use the book language to impress other people. So when I say non-existence after having been, you will be thinking, what is Bhante saying? So if we want to impress people, we use the language of the books, but it may not serve the purpose of saying, right? So we want people to understand, not to show our knowledge of the books. So we should put it in another way so that everybody can understand, and that is what? Disappearing after arriving. So now you understand very easily, right? So disappearing and after arising is the characteristic of impermanence. So if you want to know whether a certain state is permanent or impermanent, you try to see whether it disappears after arising. And among arising and disappearing, it is more important to see the disappearing than arising. Because if you may think that state is permanent, because you see the arising only. So it is important that you see the disappearing. But disappearing is preceded by arising. When there is no arising, there can be no disappearing. So these two go together, arising and disappearing. So when you see some state arise and disappear, you know that that state is impermanent. So disappearing after arising is the characteristic or mark or sign of impermanence. Now the third one is translated as contemplation of impermanence. The Pali word is anicca nupassana. The word anupassana is made up of anu and passana. Now you know the word passana, it occurs in the word vipassana also. So passana means seeing, and anu here means again and again. So anupassana means seeing again and again, or repeated seeing, or repeated observation. But it is popularly translated as contemplation. So when we translate it as contemplation, we may think that it is just thinking about the impermanence and not really seeing. We can think about, and we can force ourselves to seem to understand by saying impermanent, 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 and so on. So that is not the real understanding of impermanence. So this we must also take into account. Sometimes people say, oh, I say this is impermanent, I say this is impermanent, and they think that they really know the impermanence of that thing. Actually, what they are doing is just repeating, like a parrot. So impermanence here is the moment-to-moment impermanence. So we need to see the moment-to-moment impermanence to gain vipassana knowledge. Because the other kind of impermanence, let us call it superficial impermanence, it can be understood without meditation. You drop a glass and it breaks and you say it is impermanent. And that kind of impermanence, to understand that kind of impermanence, you don't need to practice meditation. You just know it. Or maybe somebody dies and then you say, oh, he is impermanent. That kind of understanding is not called vipassana knowledge. That kind of understanding cannot lead us to dispassion towards five aggregates. When there is no dispassion towards five aggregates, there will be no fading away of mental defilements, and there will be no attainment of enlightenment. So the superficial understanding of impermanence will not lead us to enlightenment. And that kind of understanding cannot help us to be dispassions towards the aggregates, or to be disenchanted with the aggregates or with mind and matter. So it is very important that when we say, I understand impermanence, then it must be the deeper understanding of impermanence and not the superficial one. It is said that there are three characteristics, right? Impermanence, suffering, and not so. It is said that even when there were no Buddhas in the world, people can teach impermanence and suffering. But nobody except the Buddha can teach not self. Okay, it's too long. So let me define anicca and nupassana before I forget. So anicca and nupassana is repeated seeing of impermanence while observing the rise and fall of aggregates. Now, it must be the seeing or understanding while observing the rise and fall of aggregates. It is not understanding without observing the five aggregates, but just by thinking. So it does not mean like that. So if it is to be anicca nupassana, it must be the seeing of impermanence while in the process of watching the rise and fall of the aggregates. So that is the real, genuine anicca nupassana. So you know that we experience anicca nupassana only when we are practicing vipassana meditation and seeing the rise and fall of aggregates. If we are not practicing vipassana, if we are doing some other thing, we do not have anicca nupassana. We may have experience during the practice, but when we are out of practice, there is no anicca nupassana, only the remembrance of anicca nupassana, memory of anicca nupassana. So the real anicca nupassana can arise only during the practice of vipassana meditation. A few moments ago I said that even when there is no Buddha in the world, impermanence and suffering can be taught. Do you agree with that? Now, there is a statement of the Buddha himself, or in the text, that when one characteristic is seen, the others are also seen. That means if you see anicca, if you see impermanence, you also see the suffering nature and not self nature. And it is said that anatta can be taught by Buddhas only. So when there were no Buddhas, can you really get the anicca nupassana? Can anicca nupassana be taught? It is not my thinking. I'm not that penetrative in thinking. The Tika, the sub-commentary, puts up that statement or that comment. He said, the kind of impermanence that can be taught when there is no Buddha must be just the superficial impermanence, not the real moment-to-moment impermanence, because according to that statement, if one sees moment to moment impermanence, at the time when there is no Buddha, then he will see the non-self nature also without the Buddha. So the Digha says, even the impermanence and suffering that they say can be taught during a time when there is no Buddha must be just the superficial anicca and superficial dukkha, and not the real anicca and dukkha that we see through vipassana meditation. Next, Venerable Sariputta said, a virtuous and instructed bhikkhu should carefully attend to the five aggregates subject to clinging as suffering. So the second aspect is suffering. So the bhikkhu must practice vipassana meditation so that he sees or he understands the five aggregates of clinging as suffering. Now here also there are two kinds of suffering, superficial and real suffering. So superficial suffering does not need vipassana meditation to understand. So we can easily understand the superficial dukkha or suffering. So we cut our finger and then we say, oh, it is dukkha, right? Or we hit against something and then we say, it is dukkha. So that kind of understanding of dukkha is superficial. We don't really see the dukkha nature, but we just see the displeasurable feeling involved there, and then we see it as just suffering. So understanding such a thing as suffering, to understand such a thing of suffering, we don't need meditation. We just know it. But the suffering we are talking here is the real suffering, a deep understanding of suffering. With regard to dukkha also, the commentaries say we must understand three things. What is it that is dukkha? What is the characteristic of dukkha? And what is dukkha nupassana, seeing dukkha? What is it that is dukkha? It is easy to answer. Again, the five aggregates. So the five aggregates are called dukkha or suffering. So when we say suffering, we mean the five aggregates. Here also, five aggregates in general and not five aggregates of clinging in particular. So it includes all. And what is the characteristic of dukkha? Now we must understand the meaning of the word dukkha correctly. So normally dukkha means suffering, unpleasant feeling, unpleasant sensations and so on. But the meaning of the word dukkha goes deeper than that. So dukkha. Oh, there is a saying by the Buddha. So we must understand according to that saying. And that saying is, whatever is impermanent is dukkha. Whatever is impermanent is suffering. This we need to understand. Buddha did not say, whatever is difficult to endure is suffering or something like that. Buddha said, yeah, whatever is impermanent is suffering. So if you see something, if you know something to be impermanent, you know also that that thing is suffering. So the word, the meaning of the word suffering goes deeper than the on the surface meaning. We have to go deep into it. So in order to understand it, we must remember that saying of the Buddha, whatever is impermanent is suffering. So if you want to know whether something is suffering or not, try to see whether it is permanent or impermanent. If it is impermanent, you can just say that it is dukkha. Don't be afraid to say that it is dukkha. Because I have read books, and sometimes I'm not satisfied with what the authors say. This is subject to suffering. That is, sankharas are subject to suffering. I don't like that. Because we must have the courage to say, sankharas are suffering. Not that they are subject to suffering. They themselves are suffering. If you say it is subject to suffering, it makes the meaning a little softer. So, if we want to know whether a thing is suffering or not, then we must see whether it is impermanent or not. Once we see that it is impermanent, then we can safely say it is suffering. So suffering, the word suffering in English or the word dukkha in Pali, has more meaning than what appears on the surface. The Pali word dukkha means, yeah, suffering. Something that is difficult to endure. But here, the Buddha's definition is whatever is impermanent is suffering. So why is this called suffering? Why is something permanent called suffering? Sometimes we enjoy. We enjoy good food. We enjoy good companionship and so on. Many things we enjoy. Are those dukkha? When you are taking good food, you say, oh, I am suffering. But according to the Buddha, you are suffering. So when you are enjoying the good food. So why are they called suffering? We must understand that. That is a characteristic of suffering. And the commentary gives three reasons for saying that something is suffering. So the commentary gives three reasons why the five aggregates of clinging are called suffering. Now the first reason is that they are called suffering because they are constantly oppressed by rise and fall. Now this you must note firmly. This is the meaning of dukkha. Constantly oppressed by rise and fall. So constant oppression by rise and fall is a characteristic of dukkha. So if you want to know something, whether it is dukkha or not, try to see whether it has a beginning, it has a rising and falling. If it has a rising and falling, then it is said to be oppressed by rising and falling, and that oppression is what dukkha means. So five aggregates of clinging, or all five aggregates, are called dukkha because they are constantly oppressed by rise and fall. So if you look at everything in the world, you see that everything is oppressed by rise and fall. And that rise and fall is constant, constantly oppressed by rise and fall. Can you find a single moment when there is no rise or no fall? Can you find a single moment when this process of rise and fall stops? From the moment you take conception, this rise and fall begins to oppress you. And then it goes on and on during life, and there is not a single moment when you are free from rise and fall. So always there is rise and fall, rise and fall, rise and fall. And so if you see the during meditation, if you see things you note as rising and falling, one after another, maybe hundreds of objects, you get the impression that, oh, it is oppressed by rising and falling. This rising and falling is a kind of oppression. Now, falling means the destruction, right? So something described as destruction is a kind of oppression, and rising is a precursor to falling. So it rises so that it can fall. So the falling is also a kind of oppression. And so these two oppress the four or five aggregates every moment. That is why it is called constant oppression by rise and fall. So this constant oppression by rise and fall is the characteristic of dukkha. So if you understand dukkha in this way, you can accept that enjoying good food is also dukkha. Whatever you are enjoying is dukkha. So there is nothing which is out of dukkha. So you can accept that, and you can accept the teachings of the Buddha that five aggregates of clinging are suffering. In the first sermon, when explaining the first noble truth, Buddha said in the end, in brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. So that means, in brief, everything in the world is suffering. And if you understand this meaning, the constant oppression by rise and fall, then you can easily accept the truthfulness of the Buddha's explanation. If you don't understand this, you may want to argue against Buddha's teaching. There is some kind of sukha in enjoyment and so on. So this, I want you to understand, and I want you to hold on to it firmly, that the meaning of dukkha is constant oppression by rise and fall. And we will stop here.